Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Well, welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory. And we're going to talk about the kingdom of God, and we're going to be in Leviticus 12. And Leviticus 12 is really a short message, but one of the problems with Leviticus 12 is that there is a confusion as to why Moses is putting all the stuff in between Leviticus 11, you know, food laws, and Leviticus 12 is about childbirth, and there's all these rituals, and we're heavily dependent upon the Hebraic text as to what Moses was truly trying to explain to the people. He was actually talking about a system of self-government. They'd been under the system of Egypt. Now they were in a different system that Moses was setting up along with Aaron, and some of the times they're talking about, sometimes God says to Moses, and then he says to Aaron, certain things, so that Aaron and Moses part that information off to the people. Sometimes he's just speaking to Moses, and these are little clues in the text. Why does he speak to Aaron and Moses, and then only speaks to Moses? And of course, we saw that in the previous chapter where they're talking about the food laws. Because what people don't often realize is that you have to have, if you're going to have a single government, that government's going to play certain roles in society. They're either going to play those roles in society, provide those services in society through faith, hope, and charity, or force, fear, and fealty. You're going to be subject to government like they were in Egypt. They had to pay in 20%, and the government provided a system of social welfare, free bread for the people in the time, hard times. Now, some of that free bread was obviously because there was a famine in the land. But in most countries, as we see with Sumer and other countries, they had a system of welfare that you might not have national famine, but individual famine, and they might provide some sort of welfare for the people during that individual famine. So, for when you go to a commercial break, if we're going to go to commercial breaks. But anyway, in this particular chapter, chapter 12, like I say, it has to do with childbirth. And there are certain rules in this childbirth that allows the woman to be considered unclean. And it talks about separation of her with her infirmity as she is unclean. I'll just read the first few verses. And the Lord spake to Moses, saying, not to Moses and Aaron, but to Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, saying, if a woman have conceived seed and born a male child, then she shall be unclean 7 days, according to the days of the separation of her infirmity, shall she be unclean. This is like when she has her period, where she's issuing blood. Anytime people, blood was the seed of the soul, but it also disease could be passed on when you're bleeding or if you have an open discharge. You know, you can get an infection. And of course, after a woman, many women died in childbirth because of infections. And this was spread to them a lot of times by doctors when they started having birth in hospitals, because the doctors weren't washing their hands, etc. Washing was a big part of the rituals of health education and welfare in Leviticus's explanation of what people should be doing and not doing. But over a period of time, the rabbis and Pharisees shifted away from the true message of Moses And they became steeped in rituals and ceremonies and stone temples. When the stone temple was destroyed, we see there is a shift in what a lot of rabbis were teaching and what they were saying to the people. And, you know, I can think of a few different rabbis where this was a real situation. Rabbi Johann ben Zaki, he wrote back in the first century. And he started saying with the temple, once it was gone, they couldn't do a lot of the rituals. And so they started moving more after the idea of charity rather than animal sacrifice. Well, always animal sacrifice was pointing to charity. You are either living by faith, hope, and charity, or you are living by force, fear, and fealty to governments that exercise authority one over the other, where the people become possessions of the gods of government, the rulers of government, the judges of government, the kings. There was no king in Israel because they had a system of social welfare based on charity. That's what Christ preached, and he preached it because that's what Moses was preaching. So I mentioned this, Rabbi Johanan ben Zaki, because he wrote a great deal, and you could see him in his writings shifting back to the idea that if we're going to stay together as a society, we have to create these charitable bonds where Jews depend upon other Jews, and so they gathered together in communities, and they developed their own system of social welfare within the synagogue pattern of 10 families. And then, of course, eventually there were other people who took on the Jewish religion and took on the Bible, but took on a lot of the rituals, had their hair a certain way, their beard a certain way. But it has nothing to do with the way in which you have locks in your hair or beards or even these things that they're mentioning here in Leviticus 12. It has to do with whether or not you care about the other people that are in your network that they called Israel. Israel was this network. 10 families gathered together. They take care of one another, but that's not a nation. That's just 10 families. So then 10 congregations of the people would gather together and they would pick a minister. And this eventually created a whole national network, which we see very clearly in the history of Israel. And it bound the people together. They had no king, but they had courts that came out of this same network. They had a system of charity that came out of this network because the ministers were actually the ministers of society. They were health, education, and welfare. And so that's why they gave the food laws also to Aaron and the priests, because they didn't want Aaron and the priests when they were, you know, they would receive sheep or they would receive oils or they would receive, they could exchange those things, sell those things, and buy other things with them, because they were providing pure religion to the people. Pure religion is taking care of the widows and orphans and needy of society, unspotted by the world, and the word world there is constitutional orders and systems of government, because constitutional orders and systems of government exercise authority one over the other to provide those same benefits. But they were forbidden to do that. And that's why Christ forbid us to do that. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, he says we're not to be like the governments of the Gentiles who exercise authority one over the other, but call themselves benefactors. This is the difference between true Israel and fake Israel. True Christianity and fake Christianity. But again, those are the basics. If you have those basics, now you can look at Leviticus 12 and they're saying you have a male child. She's like she's unclean. She has this separation. She's not going to have intercourse with anybody for 8 days. At least in the 8th day of the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised. So they were very particular about cutting off the tip of that circumcised flesh. But Moses talks about, the Old Testament talks about circumcision of the heart. That's what is really important. The ritual plays a factor in that primitive society, because when people wanted to join them, they supposedly had to get circumcised too. Well, again, it's circumcision of the flesh became important to the people who saw the stone temple as the temple of God. But if they saw the individuals as the stones of the temple, then they knew that circumcision of the heart was more important than circumcision of the flesh. But when you unmoor the metaphor from its true meaning, the people will start to focus on the ritual and the form and the, you know, shape of the temple instead of the shape of your heart. The shape of your activities, the condition of your activities in society, and lose sight of the moral. Probably in modern day, this is very obvious to people who aren't Muslims. They see the Muslims kneel down and pray 6 times a day, very devout, but then they go off and they beat their wives, not all of them, but many of them do. They abuse young girls, many of them do, not all of them. I mean, there's, what, 2 billion Muslims in the world? But the idea of having these rituals that you perform, we can find it in the Catholic Church. They'd have their holy water and their vestments and their incense and their hosts, you know, the what they called the crumb, the wafer. But then they had the Inquisition. They crowned men kings over the people and made the people subject again to systems not unlike that of Pharaoh, which is what we see Caesar doing. Caesar was gaining more and more power as the imperator, the commander-in-chief of the military, and people were taxed and drafted into his army. And Herod was creating a system of social welfare that he called Corban, which means sacrifice, a system of sacrifice, where you had to pay in. It wasn't faith, hope, and charity. It was moving back to that force, or civil penalties would kick in. And when you do that, you move away from what Moses is really trying to say. But here in this story of this very short chapter, there's only 8 verses in the chapter. There's a lot of chapters in the Bible that are shorter than that, 6 verses, 3 verses. Most of those are in Psalms. But it is a very short chapter, but again, the chapters are put in by other people. They weren't put in by Moses. At least not the, as we see the chapters. But in verse 4 it says, "And she shall continue in the blood of her purifying 33 days. She shall touch no hallowed thing, nor come into the sanctuary until the day of her purifying be fulfilled." Verse 5, "But if she bear a maid child, then she shall be unclean 2 weeks in her separation, and she shall continue in the blood of her purifying 66 days. So there's a different amount of time that they're talking about for a male child and for a female child. Well, why is that? Is there a meaning in that? You know, I was talking to people just the other day, is that, you know, and there's a lot of people talking on the internet, should women have the right to vote? And we have, you know, the destroy the patriarchy, and, you know, the patriarchy is bad, and that the idea that men and women have been at battle with each other and the patriarchy is just oppression. But the reality is that woman, by the very nature of her physical construction, you could say that a woman was made to be oppressed. She's weaker than a man. A lot of times she can run fast, but she doesn't have the comparable strength that a man has. There's very little competition, generally speaking, between men and women in physical strength. Men have a decided advantage. Hormones have made them that way. And if God made us, then God made us that way. So you could almost say that a woman was made to be persecuted. Well, you could also say that a woman was made to be protected. And, of course, she's the vessel of the next generation. And if you want to have another generation, then you have to protect the woman. So she, from the point of view of the heart of the man, is his heart circumcised. From the point of view of a man whose heart is circumcised, a woman was made to be protected. But for the man who is arrogant, and narcissistic, we can use that word, that's a very common word these days. A woman was made to be persecuted and oppressed. Let's put it that way, oppressed. And you see that the more the ritual of the religion becomes important over the morality of the religion, the more you will find women oppressed. But the patriarchy isn't oppressing the woman. The patriarchy is, under God's provision, is protecting the woman. That, you know, the woman walks in a particular position, you know, in some cultures, behind the man, because the man is protecting her. He's going out and clearing the path. You see in some of the third world countries, there's danger and filth and people who will rob and etc. But the man goes first to protect her. But a lot of the rules we see now, a woman in some of these Muslim countries can't go out without her husband. She's not allowed to do it. If she's caught out, she could be arrested. Because they're not really interested in protecting, they're interested in oppressing, because they feel more like men and it's easier to oppress a woman than it is to oppress another man. And so the decisions you make in your culture, in your society, in the circumcision of your heart is going to change the way in which you're relating to women or to men. And that's what Moses is ultimately trying to explain it by these metaphors and parameters. If you go into this idea of more modern rabbis write about this. Johann Zaki, he wrote in the first century, but just more recently there were other of these, Jonathan Sachs, who wrote, you know, more recently in our history. He was actually born the same year I was, so, but he's passed away already. He was born in 1948. But he died in 2020. He was, you know, an Oxford rabbi and wrote a great deal of the philosophy of Hebrew and the Hebrew congregations and their relationships. And he was a prominent global voice for interfaith dialogue and more philosophical relationship between religion and science. But he also talked a great deal about prayer and charity, what he called tzedakah, that became more important in the post-temple period. I believe it was extremely important in the tabernacle period, Because everybody wasn't going to the tabernacle and killing animals. The tabernacle moved around, but you're dealing with the whole nation. You might not see the tabernacle for several years. If you didn't take a trip to the tabernacle, you wouldn't see it, but maybe once every 12 years, where it would come to a village near you and be set up. And so, but you were supposed to worship from the door of your own tabernacle, because you were the congregation of the tents, of the tabernacles. Every house was a tabernacle. Every father of a household was king. Every mother of a household was queen. There were probably very few cultures, when I look back in history, that treated women so well as that early culture of Moses and Aaron. That women were extremely protected, very important. And with Christ, it's very clear that to him, a woman, although her role in society, again, is different, her position in society is going to be different. She was a sacred vessel in which the next generation would come. And if you're not in Egypt, if you're not in the bondage of Egypt, the next generation is your social security. But if you go into the bondage of Egypt, the next generation still could be your social security. But they're also going to be cursed with the debt that you left behind. And of course, that's why Peter says that through covetous practices, you would not only become merchandise, you'd become, you know, entangled again in a yoke of bondage. You would re-enter a relationship with your government like that when you were in bondage in Egypt. But you would also curse your children. So, and how did this come about? It came about because of a certain amount of pedagogical unmooring of the true meaning of Moses from what he was trying to impart to the people. And so, if we look at, you know, metaphors are not merely ornamental, but some will say that they're constitutive of educational theories and practices carrying on ideological freight and shaping worldviews. That was Botha who said that. But the reality is that what it is that when you're dealing with an abstract idea, the best way to sometimes impart it is to tell a story, to draw a picture. And the people will remember the picture, and a story is just picture in words. You know, before TV, there was radio. They would tell you a story on the radio with no pictures, but the words form the picture in your mind as you listen to the story. And storytelling goes back to, you know, the earliest cave drawings where they tell the story, and occasionally somebody who is artistic would start to draw the story on the side of the cave wall, and it survived because, of course, it was in a cave. But this telling of a story is to share an idea. I was talking to somebody just the other day, just this week, that has suffered severe PTSD, seen lots of death, you know, seen, you know, children, families, people die, dismembered, and, you know, zipped up a lot of body bags in his time. And he didn't realize what an effect it was having on him until a particular incident which caused him to go. And then he would have to have these conversations with a psychologist. And it helped him a lot. But the reality is those tens, hundreds, and thousands that they had in Israel, that's where you were supposed to have your psychology couch experience. And that's what they did when they got around the campfire at night and they told the stories. Because they shared the stories with the other men who shared the danger with them when they were out on the hunt or in the battle or whatever it was. Well, childbirth, just menstruating, is a burden that women carry. They're not supposed to be out on the battlefield where they might get gored by a, you know, a horned wildebeest or hacked by a soldier. Although those things happen, usually they didn't have to kill the woman, but they would take the woman and abuse her. And so the woman depended upon strong men, strong sons to keep her safe. And so what was this whole deal about where, okay, she's unclean for 7 days, 8 days, or 30 days, or whatever it is for, and so she's separated out. She's dealing with a new child, male or female. She's creating bonds with the new child. And of course, the bonds of the girl child will be very important because the girls are going to be raised with other girls to learn the ways of being a woman. So there will be no question as to who is a woman and what is a girl and what is to be expected in her life. She will receive her mother's counseling. Nowadays, we send our kids off to public school to have strange people counsel our children. And we wonder why society is so screwed up, because you strayed from the formula. You start sending away your 5-year-olds, your 6-year-olds, your 7-year-olds to people you don't even know. And they put all kinds of ideas in their head. But so what is it when we're reading through this short text in Leviticus 12? You know, you have a maid child, you have this different weight. You have a male child, you have this different weight. And just having a menstruated, bleeding, that's a burden. Young girls come into that, and sometimes it's very difficult. They feel isolated, whether they isolate themselves or not. How do they come out of that isolation? Of course, they wait for it to complete and the healing to take place, but then they come out with strange purification rituals. But what is really going on with this ritual? We'll read in verse 6. And when the days of her purifying are fulfilled for a son and for a daughter, she shall bring a lamb of the first year for a burnt offering. You know, this would be a yearling. A firstborn. And a young pigeon, or a turtle dove, or a sin offering. And of course, you know, we have articles so you can understand what, because she hadn't committed a sin, why is she bringing a sin offering? Well, it's a little bit of the nature of the offering, but what is the actual message? What is the actual mental and emotional pattern that Moses is setting up with what we think is an actual ritual? I mean, they're going to take this lamb and this turtle dove or the pigeon, and we're going to slaughter it and put it on a funeral pyre and burn it up. What is that all about? And it says, unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, unto the priests. So you take it to the door of the tabernacle of the congregation again. According to Moses, the people were to worship from the door of their own tabernacle. And practically speaking, that had to happen. I mean, 99% of the women, or at least 90% of the women in Israel, the tabernacle's nowhere near them. They got to take a lamb or a turtle dove all the way to the tabernacle? No. They are going to take it to the door of their own tent and give it away to the priesthood, to the ministers. And if it is the, like it's suggesting here from, you know, if you look at the actual text there, where they're talking about the first year for a burnt offering, the lamb, you know, firstling, a firstborn. And you're giving that, which we're encouraged to do all the time anyway. You're supposed to give the first offspring of every you that you have. That was to be given away. Not when it's a little tiny lamb, it's going to raise it up. But when you raise it up, it's destined to go to the priest. To what? Burn up on a pile of rocks? No. To fund the social welfare, the social health education and welfare of the whole nation. Now, the guy you're going to give it to is not some priest way off at a tabernacle that could be 20, 50, 100 miles away. You're going to give it to the minister that you have there. And he's connected with all the others. So it ends up in that network. It's fed into that network. And now he can distribute it to other people. You won't even be there when it's distributed. Chances are you might be. But what you're doing is you're taking something you have and giving it away for the benefit of somebody else. You know, for the last 3, 5, 6 days, 7 days, maybe 30 days, you've been recovering and healing and isolated. And the first thing you're going to do to change that feeling of isolation is give a gift out to other people. We still do that, where we give gifts. You know, baby showers, all these things. Of course, those gifts are going to the woman who just had the baby or about to have the baby in preparation. But it's what it's doing is showing other people in your community care about you. And the beginning of the destruction of narcissism in your society is that you have to start caring about other people. So you're not just jump-starting the social welfare system of a free society. You're jump-starting your own concern and care for that society. You're thinking outside of the difficulties that you had. Now, if you tell them to do this at the beginning of their cycle, they're not really in the mood. They're having difficulties, and they're feeling the pain, they're feeling the isolation, they're feeling the subjectivity. You know, they were just born a woman, and now they have this extra burden, and they have to deal with it. And it can make you feel a little isolated, a little depressed, a little downtrodden. The guys don't have to deal with that. Of course, at the time you're dealing with it, you're not really thinking about the fact that, yeah, the guys who get sent off to war, the guys who have to go fight the wildebeest, they have difficulties too. You're just feeling your own pain. And that's the way it often is. And, you know, for what I've taught my kids since I was, they were very little, and it was what I learned when I was back in the 50s. I had lots of pain, lots of difficulties, health-wise. And I learned the more I would accept the pain, go to the pain, feel the pain, the more I could overcome the pain, the more I could overcome the difficulty. You know, and when I worked for the United States federal government, they used to tell you, face danger. That was a rule they said in driving in the mountains, etc. And they'd say, face danger. So you would never back up to the precipice. You would, when turning a vehicle around in the middle of a mountain road, you would keep the vehicle so it faced the danger. Because backing up, you could end up with your back wheels going over. Well, that's the same way with health issues. That when there's a danger of your health, you face it. You deal with it. You go to the pain. You experience it. You accept it. You accept it the same as you might accept a gift. You treat it as if it's a gift. That's not so easy. But you know that when you get through it, that, and this is, evil has to get girls thinking that having children, having a family, having a husband, being in a patriarchy is a bad thing. It's actually a good thing, but they have to destroy the family. I heard a Jewish author just, actually it was in the last week, was talking about their experiment with kibbutzes in early Israel. And I had read a little bit about kibbutzes and everything, but he put it very succinctly. Of course, he's written a whole book on the subject. Is that they had to, and he actually put it in these terms, they had to destroy the family. So you know right away that the kibbutz, as we see it, that what we call the kibbutz, is destructive to the family. It's because you would actually isolate the women and the children, even from their mothers. And the children would be raised by some sort of like nursery. And of course, that's what they're doing with public schools. And so you break down those bonds. But here in Leviticus 12, it's very clear that Moses is saying, no, she doesn't have to worry about anything but that child for weeks. She has to focus on the child and her relationship with the child. Nobody else is going to put other demands. She can't go out and touch this thing and that thing, and she can't do all the cooking. She just got to take care of the child. That's what he's trying to say. He didn't care about whether it was a pigeon or a turtle dove or a lamb, that killing this lamb is somehow going to make things better. Giving a gift, as if it was a sin offering, as if it was, the first fruits offering, and giving up entirely after you've healed, this is going to bring you back into the congregation. That's what he's talking about. But the people who want to say, oh no, we got to do this and that. And of course, when they took the temple away, then they didn't have stone altars and they were dispersed in a lot of ways. Then they said, okay, how will we get back? Well, common sense will tell you how to get back so that you're a people again. Is that you start taking care of one another. As if you actually cared about other people. And that's what the woman is doing here, like we see in verse 7, who shall offer it before the Lord and make an atonement for her. Atonement? She didn't sin. That's not what atonement means. And of course, this is one of the things in, I'm going through and doing each of these individual chapters and trying to help people understand what the Bible is really talking about. It requires that I end up writing other articles in support of this so that you understand what atonement is. And so I've been adding to our article on atonement so you realize that you're not paying for some sort of sin. This isn't even a sin. This is a thing to celebrate. But you went through a difficulty and now you have to share with others. And you share with others and it will help heal you and your relationship with God. When the people go out and, they kill a woolly mammoth and one of the guys gets injured and another guy maybe even gets killed and you see him stomped by the woolly mammoth and then you come back and you got to go out hunting again. You're going to have PTSD. And as you sit down with your buddies and you talk about it, and guys say, yeah, I was really afraid. Well, Steve was afraid, but he ran up there, and he did this. And and they share their experience with others. And it helps them heal. I gave the example that when a dog is learning, you know, to chase whatever, you know, like a coon dog goes out and chases coons, trays them, and then his master shoots them. Sometimes they'll corner them and actually kill them. The coon's going to try to get the coon dog to chase him into the water. And then the coon will get on the back of the dog and drown the dog. Actually holds on to the dog's ears and holds his nose under so the dog can't swim and get up for air until the dog drowns. Because the coon wants to survive, but the coon dog wants to get the coon. And there's a lot of emotion involved in this and adrenaline involved in this hunting. But you watch that coon dog when he's sleeping. And you'll see him, his feet start moving as if he's almost running in his sleep. And you'll hear little tiny barks coming out of the coon dog while he's sleeping. What's he doing? He's replaying the events in his dreams. Dog's dream. Because we record these things and then we relive them. But of course, you know, the human mind is a lot more complex. So you go out and you're on D-Day and you're invading and you see your buddy shot and killed and stuff like that. And there's no time to sit around. You're exhausted and you never deal with it. And you come back with PTSD and you wake up in the middle of the night and you think you're in the war again. So they try to treat PTSD. Well, the best way to do that is to get with other guys who've gone through it and talk it out as if you're confessing. Confessing about your fear. Confessing about your anxiety. Confessing about the difficulty of that. And you have to do it with people who have a sympathetic ear. And that's part of the construction of a society where if it is attacked, people come out and defend it. You know, a guy goes up against a foe, a raptor, a dinosaur or whatever, or saber-toothed tiger that's trying to kill his family and eat his family. And he faces it. With a stick, a sharp stick. Well, he's brave. But today we have people that are cowering in their houses with anxiety. But they tell them that if you put a psychological name on it, ADHD or anxiety or bipolarism, then it's not your fault anymore. It's not your difficulty to deal with anymore. It's a disease you caught. No, you're a coward. Confess it. Admit it. You're afraid. Get together with other people. Start learning, you know, touching, you know, the guy who's courageous. Why is he courageous? Was he not afraid? He wasn't subject to his fear. He wasn't subject to his anxiety. He experienced it, but he faced the danger anyway. And a woman who's going to have children, you know, there are women who dread the idea of having children. I think a lot of that dread is put into them. What Moses is doing with these rituals is relieving the dread. And so you're sharing with others. You're celebrating with others. You're giving to others. You're not just thinking about yourself. And that's what the guys, when they all sit around in the campfire and they talk about the dangers they face, the war they face, the wild animals and the beasts that they face, they share their experience. And those that have courage share with those that don't have courage. I'm paraphrasing off of Justin the Martyr's apology, explaining Christianity to the Emperor Antoninus Pius, who was upset with the people, the Christian people, who did not sacrifice at their temple, did not put funds into their temple to be redistributed to the needy in the free bread of society. They didn't do that. They had private religion. They took care of the needy of their society through private religion. So by doing that, they were able to take care of the needy of their society because they had the bread, the funds, the resources to do it. And so they could rightly divide the bread from house to house. But the Romans, they either took away from their enemies, you know, taxes, tribute, or they did have lots of, you know, the lot of businesses that the Roman government owned. This is what the Temple of Janus was. They would have these projects. They would own mines. And they would fund them through the Temple of Janus. So you brought in money and you invested it in this project. And they would fund an expedition to Spain to mine a mountain that had gold in it or silver. And they would go up there and they'd mine it and they'd bring back the silver to the Temple of Janus. And they would divide up what they got. And if you invested in this project, you would get your investment back plus a share once they started showing a profit. And they did the same thing with shipping, and they did the same thing with salt mines, and they did the same thing with harbors. They would go and build a harbor, and then that harbor would collect fees when ships docked at the harbor. And it would bring back money to the people who invested in it. This was going on in their temples. We call it the stock exchange now. But, which doesn't create much camaraderie. But that's what religion was to do, is to bind the people. Religiare has to do with binding the people together where they cared about one another. But if you bind the people together with contracts, covenants, and constitution, you're still going to have to sacrifice. And if you don't sacrifice, men will come and punish you. But if you have a system based on God's way, which is what Moses is trying to explain to you, what Jesus is trying to explain to you, then you will have a system of social welfare based on charity. And there's a lot of nuances in that. In order to keep that charity alive in you, you have to, at every event, every major event, every life's challenge, you have to share with other people to bring you back so you don't feel isolated anymore. You know, one of the things about childbirth, a lot of women admit this or confess it, that, you know, the childbirth is difficult and painful and draining. I saw a woman who had just given birth, and the nurse was explaining to her about nursing the baby, and she was nursing the baby. And the mother was like, he stopped sucking. What is something the matter? Well, no, he's just resting. This is his first time he's ever had a meal. And he said, are you stressed? Are you okay? And she said, no, I'm okay. You could just see she was just overwhelmed. All kinds of things were going on in her. And this would be going on in this period where she would be somewhat isolated from men, isolated from daily chores. And of course, there's plenty of women who still took care of all the other kids and still did the chores and still did all these things, even after they gave birth. But the idea of this is written down, that she has to be treated special. it wasn't isolating her. It was isolating her from all the tasks that normally she would have to deal with. Other people would be doing this. Midwives would be taking care of the needs of the family. Your neighbors would be coming over. You wouldn't have to cook a meal. They would be doing it. They would be checking on you. Now that you go away to the hospital and run up a $20,000-$30,000 bill. And you have no community. And then when there's a pandemic coming on, I just heard again this morning about more difficulties of people who got the jab. You know, having more and more physical deformities where they're having difficulties. Anybody who listens to people like Peter McCullough and other people, you can see that hospitals, or Ron Johnson, I think his name was, I know Ron Johnson, I think it's Johnson who works for Congress, has been very open about the fact that the hospitals were getting millions and millions of dollars in subsidies if they said you have COVID or if you got ventilated. If you got ventilated, they made more money. So suddenly they have a financial interest in ventilating you. But ventilating a lot of people killed them. There were much better ways of dealing with their respiratory problems. And other doctors were finding this out, especially in countries that did not give them the financial incentive of ventilating. We won't go through all that. But the point is that if you don't create a society that has to make the choice to care about one another as much as they care about themselves, care about other families as much as they care about their own family. You can imagine, you know, in a small community that a young woman has her first child, all the women of that community are going to try to help her out. All the women of that community are going to come over and they'll do chores for her. They'll cook meals. The men will bring things to provide that family, because that family has enriched their community, added another person to their community. And this is a blessing on the whole community. And her sacrifice that she brings afterwards is just, everybody's been waiting on her, taking care of her, and concerned about her. And now she has to be concerned about, she has to make this sacrifice, as if it was a sin offering, but no sin was committed. And so, if you look at these events and understand people, see, it's one thing, you know, I didn't go through a lot of the Hebrew words, and in the next few chapters, like I said, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, they're all dealing with some of these strange things. And when we get into 13, 14, they'll bring up certain words. They're still arguing about what those words mean, like leprosy. The word wink shows up. Now there's several words for wink, but that's the way they translate it. And it could be that we'll deal with that when we deal with that chapter. But what they're dealing with is real society, real issues, real problems, real emotional issues, real psychological issues, real spiritual issues that are common in the threads of society and in cultures all over the world. And religion, remember, religion just 200 years ago was the pious performance of your duty to God and your fellow man. Well, your fellow man, you're only going to be able to have, what, 5, 10, 15 children? I don't know, some people have had, I guess, like 20. But the reality is that And I just heard again today, of course it's been rumored for quite some time, that there isn't a billion people in China. There's like a billion people missing in China. That their population, they really are facing population collapse. And there are things that they're doing now to try to increase their population. They're not trying to, you know, the one-child contract is done away with. It was a devastating idea. Most countries, European countries, are facing population collapse of whole races of people. But there's also an invasion of other cultures coming from all over the world. And those cultures, are they going to bring prosperity or totalitarianism? Well, the Muslim religion brought in a great deal of totalitarianism from 700 AD on. The caliphates and the Ottoman Empire and slavery. I mean, it was the Muslim religion that promoted slavery more than any other. It took some of the Western ideologies of what we call Judeo-Christian ideology that removed that slavery. But we've still gone under the bondage of Egypt. Bondage of Egypt, 20% of your labor belongs to the government. Maybe it's 30%, maybe it's 40%. I mean, there's 14% just to fund Social Security. 14% of your labor is going to go to funding Social Security. And it won't be enough. But then what also happens, corruption comes in. And that's another one of those supportive pages. I've quoted Edward Gibbon's the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire many, many times, but I never ever created a page on Edward Gibbons. And Edward Gibbons had the idea that the Roman Empire collapsed because of Christianity. That's what they say. But actually, if you read it chapter by chapter, I don't see that conclusion. But of course, I'm reading it with a preconceived information that I had already got from reading hundreds and hundreds of other history books, and also because of my perspective of what Christianity really is and really was. Now, there are two forms of Christianity. There's the early church, and there's the Church of Constantine. The early church, like Justin the Martyr was saying in that apology to Antoninus Pius, we gather once a week. And those that have, share with those that don't have enough. And of course, that's the quote that I was referring to when I said those men who had to face danger, gather, talk about it, share their fears, share their anxieties, and share their courage. And those that have courage, share with those that don't have enough. And of course, judge not lest ye be judged. You know, care about others. So you have to create a society, a culture, that emphasizes caring for others. Those you know, those you don't know. Cast your bread upon the waters. This is an example of caring for those that you may not even know. You're going to, after you faced a difficulty, you relieve the difficulty of others. You step over into the mindset of relieving the difficulties of others, knowing human nature, knowing small communities and village mentality already. You know, when you see, who shall offer it before the Lord and make an atonement for her, and she shall be cleansed from the issue of her blood. This is the law that hath born a male or a female. And even the word law there, if I remember right from the Hebrew text, isn't Torah, but Torah. And we've talked about that before. The word Torah is actually a different word. I mean, it certainly has the base of Torah in it. But it begins and ends with faith. As that was the one thing that Israel was doing. They didn't live by entitlements like they did in Egypt. They lived by faith. But because they didn't live by entitlements, the government had no entitlement to them. No, it could not force their contribution. So at every opportunity, you had to come up in your culture with the opportunity of atonement, the opportunity of giving to others, receiving life and giving life. You had to do that. If you want forgiveness, Jesus says, you have to forgive. If you don't forgive, neither will you be forgiven. If you don't give, neither will you be given unto. So, all you're looking at in these descriptions of Moses is not superstitious rituals, but you're looking at a mindset where you care about others as much as you care about yourself. And so in verse 8 it says, and if she be not able to bring a lamb, then she shall bring two turtle doves. And there's a particular word there for turtle doves. If you go back to Abraham's original, and I'm going to bring this up in these subsequent chapters, all the way up into, probably all the way up into Deuteronomy, but it's certainly up into Leviticus 15. That his original vision of the smoking furnace and the burning lamp. That when you sacrifice of yourself willingly, you choose to sacrifice. You choose to take care of your baby. You choose to take care of your children, to educate your children, to raise up your children, to discipline your children, to show them the right way. You take the time to do it. Then there's an opening. It opens a door where light can come in. It opens a window so light can come in. And that's the smoking furnace. Is the sacrifice that is burnt up, given up, your life given up, will bring the burning lamp that will show you the way. But people will come up and say, oh no, the way is you gotta be circumcised, you gotta get baptized, you gotta use holy water, you gotta get communion, you gotta get a little wafer, you gotta do, you know, whatever the rituals are. And whatever religion you have, you know, you gotta go door to door and, you know, share the watchtower with people or whatever your dogma, your private religion, which is not, your real religion is the government religion. That's where you go to get your daily bread. You don't go to the church to get your daily bread. You go to the church to get your crumb. You know, the symbols of righteousness, not righteousness. See, righteousness requires that you actually care about your neighbor as much as you care about yourself. You have to love your neighbor as yourself. That's where we find righteousness. But that's not what modern religion is doing. Modern religion says, no, go to the governments of the Gentiles, the governments of the world that exercise authority, and they will be your benefactor. And we will crown those men to rule over you and bring you back into the bondage of Egypt. That's where the modern church is gone. The modern synagogue is gone. So, like I said, this turtle dove. You know, the base word is tav, vav, resh. And the vav, like I say, is a joining or separating letter. And so you're separating tov, faith, from the power. And that was one of the things in his vision. And I'll just mention it here. You can go, I'm increasing our article on this smoking furnace and burning lamp. But the turtle dove was not, even though we see it divided sometimes, but in the vision, it was on one side of the burning furnace. It was separated out. And of course, like I said, that had to do with, you know, the turtle dove goddess of Sumer, that you completely move out the idea of force. But even the same letters also are translated seek and order and estate. And of course, that's really what you're doing when it says, okay, you give a lamb, which is almost a denomination, or you give a turtle dove. What they're saying is that you give a piece of your estate, something. You give something that you have of value that belongs to you. You cast that bread upon the waters. You give it to your minister, and he will put it into the priest system of social welfare, and it will go out to others, along with your thoughts and concern. But if you've unmoored the meaning of these sacrifices, then you think that, oh, because I gave this up, now God owes me something. God doesn't owe you. You're doing it because God wants you to care about others as much as you care about yourself. You've had some time to heal, now start caring about other people. For a short period of time, you know, like during menstruation, you're just concerned about your own pain. It really is not conducive to you to think about others. But once that pain is gone, now you can start thinking about others. And it's not about atonement, it's about reuniting you with the Spirit of God. Because the whole reason you exist is because God cares about you. It's in the nature of God to give life. It's in the nature of caring about others that you give life. It says, bring two turtles, meaning turtle doves, two young pigeons. Again, you know, you can look at these different words like young pigeon and turtle dove. Some of those same words. Because it's like biet nun, which is the word, is from a word that means to build. And, it can mean you're a child of somebody. It can mean the word first. It's translated the word first. It's a conceptual idea where you're giving these things, a dove or a pigeon. You know, it's a more complex word. It's yad nun hay. It actually can be the same as the word wine. You see the word wine. Are you supposed to give wine? Or are you supposed to give a pigeon? Which is it? The idea, there's a lot of ideas inculcated in these formulation of these letters, but they want to restrict it down. And it's amazing that they'll restrict it down and they'll say, well, it's a dove. You have to have a dove. You have to bring a dove. Well, do you? Or like I said before, is it just a piece of your estate that they're talking about? Something that belongs to you that you have to give up. I mean, you've already been bleeding, and that's to prepare you for the next cycle where you can become a vessel of a living creature, a son or a daughter that will be the seed of the next generation. That's pretty amazing. Absolutely amazing. But that's your opportunity to give life. But that if you're healed, now you have to think about giving life to the nation, not just to your family. So there was always this balance. If you start reading the Bible from that point of view, there is your life, your relationship with God, and then there's your relationship with your family. But then both man and woman in the patriarchy has a relationship with the nation. And of course, Jesus says, call no man father. That's when you start taking the role that should be encapsulated in the family alone, where the choice is made. Because the congregation can't make you give. The 51% of the people in your nation can't make you give. That is a choice you have to make, because to choose to give is going to create different results than giving out of guilt or giving out of civil authority. Both those things are going to affect the outcome. And the outcome has to be the burning lamp. It has to be turning the lights on. And we'll see over and over again that when you go to the system, the welfare that is a snare and a trap, there is a table, Paul says, that should have been for your welfare, but it's actually a snare and a trap. He goes on to say that it will darken your eyes. Why? Because it will not bring the burning lamp. It won't bring the insight that comes with that reunion with the Spirit of God that is the spirit of giving and forgiving. So, you have to realize that this is what the testament is about. It's a psychological, spiritual message showing you the ways of God. And the ways of God is to give life to others. And probably the most radical way in which we give life to others is birth. And a woman is at the core of that birth, where she literally gives her life into that child. But then the husband, if he's not an oppressor, and this is the dynamics of this, even if you have a cultural religion that allows you to oppress women, and there certainly are religious ideologies that allow you to oppress women, the very nature of this should spawn that concern in your own heart, which is a part of that circumcision of the heart, where you won't oppress your wife. You'll see that she does and what she does as a blessing. And you will extend to her the same choices you would like extended to you. And the same nurturing effects that you would like her to extend to you, you will extend to her. And it will be her choice, and it will be your choice, because choice is what God has given us. So we should be giving that choice to one another. But if you've created a society like FDR, where you don't have a choice anymore, you have to give. And the priests of your society are public employees, because you're now engaged in public religion. The light of the lamp is not going to come unto you. you're going to end up living in darkness. And in that darkness, another spirit will take over. It will take over your government. It will take over your bureaucracy. It will be full of corruption. It will be taking and taking and taking and taking. Which is why you have USAID. Do you think that Doge was going to be your salvation? I thought it was great when Doge started finding this corruption and pointing it out. I thought it was great when Trump was stirring up these realities, the vision of these realities, by creating Doge, by examining these things. But that's just stirring the pot, and it brings things to the surface, and you can say, well, that shouldn't be in there. But the reality is, what's going to change the nation is the circumcision of the heart. It is a willingness to gather together and care about others as much as you care about yourself. So this is really what the message is all about. Now, of course, many scholars and commentators note that these regulations would have provided a real-world protection in ancient contexts without modern medicine, antibiotics, hygiene standards. But these were the standards that she's just going to be, you know, like I said, washing up was a really big thing. Eating right. We just went through a chapter, certain things you're going to eat. You know, I saw this lady who lives up in Canada. She's 80. I don't know, she may be almost 90 now, but I think she was 86 years old. She was talking. Still running a cattle ranch, still ranching up there. She's been a meat eater since she was a little tiny kid, because that's what they had on the ranches in northern Canada. And she is just a picture of health. Amazing. For a woman of her age, total carnivore diet. And of course that's what she was, you know, talking about, how important that was. She raised like 9 or 10 of her own kids, and then 10 problem children she got as foster kids, and raised them, and still running the cattle ranch. I don't know what she's doing right now, but when I saw the video of her talking, we see that amongst Israelites, they weren't, you know, in Egypt, a lot of the people were more vegetarian. They didn't even like the idea of eating meat. But you need to eat meat. Well, actually, there are a lot of vegetables. There are a lot of foods that grow that can provide you a diet similar to a meat diet without being meat. But if you actually look at a lot of those plants that produce, you know, the high amounts of fat, the high concentrations of vitamins, and the right balance of vitamins and minerals in them, a lot of those have been removed from our diet. You're not going to find them in the stores. Now, there is people who are bringing that back, and we'd love to do that here, but all takes a lot of work. Takes a lot of effort. And there are people that are doing it and learning more and more about those things. But so there is a certain reality that hygiene-wise, this was a good thing. Health-wise, they did have antibiotics, not pharmaceutical antibiotics, but they had the essential oils that can have an antibiotic and actually proper caring for the body. And they knew those things. And there's some of that's mentioned in the Bible, but a lot of that is passed down. And I ask in here why the distinction of male and female. And there's a lot written in commentaries about the fact that, you know, Male children usually go a little bit longer. The births might be a little bit more difficult. Female children are a lot of times born easier, but those are general statistics. But there's also hormonal changes that take place. A woman still carries some of the living cells of her sons in her body years and years later. And there's the presence of those male hormones. But the essential thing is this idea of the circumcision of the heart and the moving from dealing with your issues and it's just like a man goes into battle, he can shut off thinking about all the other repercussions. The person who has a lot of anxiety, he can't shut off these things. But he can shut off all the anxiety of the moment and just deal with the danger and focus on the danger. And that's part of the message of this, is that the woman has to focus on the child and the difficulties of giving birth and the healing afterwards and taking care of the child and bonding with the child and focus on that. And that's what the message of Moses is all about. But then after you do that, you don't want to become one of those moms who are just too possessive of their child. You know, boil the child in its mother's milk. And you have to start thinking about others again. And, of course, that's how you reconnect. That's what atonement is about, is reconnecting with that spirit that was so essential to make a nation like Israel function against all threats of violence, etc., and provide for them accordingly, without a king, without rulers exercising authority. Even the priesthood could not exercise authority. They could only give what was freely given them. And they should freely given it, otherwise it gets into the area of what we've talked about already, a strange fire. So on the page, I do have an article that takes you off to the Turtle Dove article, and Cities of Blood. Because if you create a system where your social welfare is provided by men who exercise authority one over the other, you're going to create the Cities of Blood. And you're not going to build a city of righteousness, but a city of blood. And, you know, we can look at Psalms 107, verse 7. And he led them forth by the right way, that they might go to a city of habitations. Habitations, that's where you're individuals in the right way. You're not a collective, but your individual habitations. Isaiah 1, verse 21. How is the faithful city become a harlot? It was full of judgment, righteousness lodged in it. But now murderers, thy silver is become dross, thy wine mixed with water. The princes are rebellious, the companions of thieves. Everyone loveth gifts, benefits, dainties, and followeth after rewards. What kind of rewards? Rewards of unrighteousness. What they also call in the New Testament, wages of unrighteousness. They judge not the fatherless. They don't take care of the widows and orphans. Neither doth the cause of the widow come unto them. And in verse 26, and I will restore thy judges as at the first, and thy counselors as at the beginning. Afterwards, thou shalt be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city. But we're not the faithful city today. We operate by men who exercise authority and force the contributions of the people. And that changes you. Like in our article on the masses. You degenerate when you institute the rule of force. When you institute the rule of the social, the New Deal of FDR. Or you're going to force your neighbor to contribute to your welfare. You're going to force the neighbor to pay for your child's education. It's going to bring in unholy elements. Isaiah 32:1. Behold, a king shall reign in righteousness, and a prince shall rule in judgment. But is Christ ruling what we're deciding today? You know, or was it Biden? Was it Trump? Was it the Bushes? Was it Bill Clinton? Was he the supreme moral character of your life? Because that's what it said in one of his executive orders, that the federal government was the supreme moral, you know, define the supreme moral character of our lives. But if our lives are dependent upon men who exercise authority, we're not following the ways of Christ. So, Matthew 5:14, ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on the candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works. Glorify your Father which is in heaven, not your Father which is in Rome. He goes on in Psalms 101:6-8, mine eyes shall be upon the faithful of the land that they may dwell with me. He that walketh in a perfect way, he shall serve me. He that worketh deceit shall not dwell within my house. He that telleth lies shall not tarry in my sight. I will early destroy all the wicked of the land, and I may cut off all the wicked doers of the city of the Lord. So this is where we're at. We've created a system that depends upon force to provide the welfare of society. If you were going to repent, you have to be thinking about creating the system of Moses and Jesus Christ that provided for the welfare of society through faith, hope, and charity. And if you don't, you'll be cut off with the wicked doers of the cities of the Lord. You're not going to be a part of the city of the Lord. Your eyes will be darkened, and you won't see where the next disaster will come from. Proverbs 11:10, when it goeth well with the righteous, the city rejoiceth. And when the wicked perish, there is shouting. By the blessing of the upright, the city is exalted, but it is overthrown by the mouth of the wicked. And the wicked are telling you that, oh, you know, we've got to restart the sacrifice of the temple. No, what you have to restart is the sacrifice of Christ. The sacrifice of the early church, the sacrifice of early Israel, not what it became. So in Revelation 22:14, blessed are they that do his commandments, that they may have right to the tree of life, and may enter in through the gates into the city. So are you entering into the cities of righteousness or the cities of blood? Have you entered into the, you know, I have several on that page, you'll see. Flesh pots and cauldron. These are other articles that talk about the same thing. Same as the cities of blood, which are mentioned over and over again in the Bible. They don't always have that phrase, cities of blood, but in Exodus 16:3, you see, and the children of Israel said unto them, would to God we had died by the hands of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, and when we did eat bread to the full. For ye have brought us forth into the wilderness to kill the whole assembly with hunger. That was some of the murmurings of the people who came out with Moses. And, you know, which we explained earlier in Genesis 11:4, where it says, and they said, go to, let us build us a city, a tower, whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And we see it in Jeremiah. They talk about innocent blood and make a chain in the land full of bloody crimes. Whenever you're forcing your neighbors to contribute to what you think everybody ought to have, you're going against Moses and Christ and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, and, you know, you're ruining your society because you've accepted a lie, which they also write about and tell about. But until then, peace on your house, and may God be with you. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.